Hello, Bill Scheer.
Good morning, Matt Lewis.
Hey, how you doing, man? It is I don't know what the deal is. There's something in the air. It just seems like a great day. Yeah.
How many years have we been doing this?
Man, that's a good question. Maybe five? Five, six?
I totally forget the start date. I can pull it up.
It's a long time.
And
you got to go past, we were the weekend blog. So if anybody looks through the transcripts of the DMZ show, that is not an accurate portrayal of the sort of long marriage that we have had.
They have the weekend blog up on the good old Blogging Head site, so I can still figure this out. So I'm sorry to.
I'm gonna say we started doing this in 2009.
So we did do this in the last midterm. We did do this in 2010.
Yes,
but I don't remember you ever. I don't remember you being this happy.
I'm not happy because of what happened. I'm happy because you have been humiliated, and that gives me great joy, Bill. You and your predictions
we started just after the 2010 midterm, so we didn't have the bond that we do today. We don't know as well as we did back then. My gut is correct. This is the most ecstatic that you have been in our entire time.
But let
together.
Me say, yeah, I think it may be. Let me say, I mean, just not that it's off topic, but for those keeping score, you were doing the blog. You were doing the weekend blog with Con Caro and other people before, and I actually had done. I mean, I did some blogging heads. I know I did a blogging heads with Anna Marie Cox. And maybe August of 2008, I think might have been my first time on the show. So we've been doing it for a little longer, but together as this team Click and Clack. And by the way, we send our condolences out to the NPR family. We are fans of Car Talk, and we tweeted, if you go to @DMZ Show. I think we tweeted, we paid homage to the brothers at one point, and somebody made a little, maybe the Blogging Heads folks, somebody made a little Car Talk sort of icon paying homage, Bill and I, as the Car Talk guys. So check that out, and we do send, that's obviously a down note on an otherwise really happy.
But I feel like throughout our whole time together, even from the beginning, you've had a certain malaise about the state of the political world. You've been a little conflicted about the state of the world, the state of your own party, and you're just feeling good right now. I mean, there's a spring in your step.
It may be the coffee talking, Bill. It may be the sleep deprivation talking. I am happy today, and it's not, I think it's sort of rooting for the story. You still in this business have to, you have to be surprised a little bit. You have to have a little bit of that sort of childlike winsome quality about campaigns and elections. It's easy to become cynical, and I certainly have been, and skeptical. But when I saw not just Republicans, and by the way, this is just I don't want to belabor a point, but let's just recap. You predicted Republicans would pick up 3 seats. And I predicted, and that was a bold prediction. I give you credit for being bold and staking out.
I appreciate that. Thank you for your credit.
An absurd and yet gutsy position. I said, I had a little bit more of a Weasley, in fairness, a little bit more of a Weasley prediction, which was that we would know election night that Republicans took the majority. In other words, we wouldn't have to wait for runoffs in Louisiana or Georgia or votes to come trickling in from Alaska. And I turned out to be right this time. But I tell you what really blows me away, Bill, is the governor's races. and places like Illinois and Maryland, my home state of Maryland, I think that makes it a wave. I was saying all along that this probably wasn't a wave, that even though I was predicting Republicans would take the Senate, I was sort of falling short of calling it a wave. I think now you have to say it was a wave, and you count in Scott Walker in Wisconsin, who won a tough race. You count Rick Scott in Florida, who won a tough race. I mean, I think the governor's races, Maryland and Illinois, for example, made it a wave.
Well, first off, since you have recalled my prediction from last week, I probably should. it's to be rallying in the back of your mind for some reason.
We can have this banter. That's the relationship that we have. That we can get away with this. It's all in good fun.
And to that point, let me remind you that my predictions were for entertainment purposes only. I was not saying take this to the bank. I wasn't saying all the polls are wrong. Ignore all you've read. I mean, I'm not shocked that
dead, Bill. Better read than dead. Better read than dead.
I mean, I am surprised by a number of things. I didn't think Republicans would essentially run the table. The lone exception of New Hampshire. And I was like me and everybody else in the world are surprised by the governor's race in Maryland, the close call in Vermont,
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts is interesting. I mean, I don't want to get into a too big of a tangent on Massachusetts because it's my home state, and I wrote about it recently for Real Clear Politics. So it's on my mind more than the others. But you know, there are two things that make me sad about today. So here are some of my liberal tears for you to feast on.
Yummy. Can you bottle those and put them in the mail?
Because I wrote earlier in September that it would be effectively good news for Democrats to lose the Senate because they already weren't going to get the House. There was no Obama legislation that was going to pass anyway. And now Republicans have the full stage to display their internal civil war and, you know, be Keystone Cops while they try to keep the government open and not default on the debt. So that part of it does not make me sad. Two things that make me sad are I don't like all these statistical models being correct. It just sort of saps all the humanness and the blood out of politics. As Nate Silver himself noted, in fact, the polls were not infallible. They had a huge skew toward the Democrats. They were showing many more close races, which ended up not being close.
Let me jump in there, Bill, because it's a good segue for me to brag about the Daily Caller, who was mocked for reporting on polling. We had polling here that showed that Ed Gillespie was within 4 points. He has not yet conceded the race, as far as I know. There may well be a recount. This was supposed to be a double digit blowout. We had it here. We were mocked. I'm going to write something up documenting some mean tweets from some well known pundits who were mocking the polling that we reported on. We had a poll here showing that Larry Hogan, I think I talked about it maybe, that Larry Hogan was within a couple of points in Maryland. He ended up winning. The governor of Virginia, Larry Hogan, whose father, I won't go into how he crushed my dreams, but
we covered that last week. The folks know.
We covered that last week. And then I want to go back a few months ago where the Daily Caller had a poll showing Eric Cantor might be in trouble, showing that Dave Brat. Now we didn't predict.
Was the same polling outfit that did both those polls?
So with the Dave Brat story, nobody saw that. Daily Caller
was
did
it the
not
same pollster that got the Brat poll right and the Hogan poll right and the Gillespie poll right or close to right?
The one in I have to check. There may be some overlap. They weren't. I think I'm confident in saying that not all that all th- they weren't all three from the same pollster. But the two Virginia might have been. I need to check that. I'm going to write about that this morning. The Maryland poll was not from the same pollster. That was Gonzalez Research. And it was paid for, in fairness, that poll was paid for by the Maryland Republican Party. But they're a respected sort of nonpartisan polling firm. But the point is that the Daily Caller on these three surprise races had it pretty close to right in terms of our reporting on other people's polling.
I mean, why should you report on this? Whether the poll was right or not is not the caller's position to judge. You're just reporting on the poll.
Well, we had it exclusively, Bill, and I think there was a sense that we were being fed oppo, that we were being fed sort of unreliable polling meant to sort of game
right,
the system, that it wasn't legit. But these polls turned out to be really much better than any, you know. I mean, again, we had my colleague Alex Pappas, more specifically, had a poll they reported on showing Ed Gillespie within 4 points a week ago of winning, and it was mocked roundly on Twitter by the intelligence, the sort of punditocracy.
But it is a reminder that reporting on or understanding politics is not just poll averages. Voting pools can be moving targets. Dynamics can break late in campaigns. It is subjective trying to determine, what the turnout, the actual makeup of the turnout's going to be. I don't know if this is going. Since there actually was some variation from the results from the polling, if people will focus on that, or they'll just say, all hail the forecasters because they got their probabilities right. I think if we reduced politics to that, it makes it, I think, in some ways harder to understand what's going on. And that kind of gets me to the other point about this being a wave. Obviously, they mostly run the table. The Republicans mostly run the table. But what does that wave mean? Is it an ideological wave? Is it an endorsement of a certain agenda? Is it just a recoiling from Obama as a person, or is it just an individual situation in these states? Just sort of spitting out wave doesn't answer
right.
that question, and so you need a lot more intimate understanding of the individual races before you can make a decision. Okay, what actually happened here? What is the public crying out for?
I think that's a spot on point. I do believe it was a wave. I don't want to change the subject, but later I'd love to hear your take on why Scott Brown wasn't part of it when everyone thought he was going to be. And then you have people like Ed Gillespie, who people had written off, who was part of the wave. I think it was a wave. I think you're right, though, to sort of drill down and say, what does it mean? And I don't think it means all that much in terms of if you're sort of reading the tea leaves and trying to divine, if this is a harbinger of things to come. I mean, I think it would be a... this election was not a referendum on conservative ideas. It's an opportunity for conservatives, I think, to govern responsibly and to, having won the election, now try to win the argument. I think it was clearly a rejection of Barack Obama's policies, which is not the same thing as an acceptance of conservative policies. And so I think it would be a huge mistake for Republicans to overread the results for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is the fact that general presidential elections look nothing like midterms. I mean, the turnout in a 2016 presidential election will be nothing like the turnout Tuesday night in the midterm. And so I think that this is really fraught with danger if Republicans sort of overreach. I'm not suggesting they should cower and turn into squishes. I'm suggesting they ought to be prudent and govern responsibly and try to bring the public along with their conservative policies instead of assuming that the public has already bought in because they have.
I disagree that I think this is a referendum on Obama's policies. Perhaps more about Obama's performance. which I think Republicans were very adept at, you know, making it impossible for him to perform and then blaming him for the bad performance. You know, the ad theme in almost all the ads were so-and-so voted with Obama 95% of the time. And they really drill down into what those votes actually were that are so awful. And you had some more generic stuff about, you know, sometimes, you know, debt and spending when the deficit has actually gone way down over the course of Obama's presidency. So it's not that's the problem. I think that there is a general dissatisfaction that things aren't getting done. And there is a desire to put in somebody different in that circumstance. So I think that's but you go to New Hampshire, for example. Why was New Hampshire different? One, I think Scott Brown is just not that bright a person, and I think it shows over time. I think he snuck it on a fluke in Massachusetts.
You know him better than me. Now you may argue, Bill, that he's not a deep person. That he's not, but he is very smart.
I wholly disagree with you.
No, he's sharp. You cannot. I mean, I think obviously the guy is very sharp. I watched the debate. There are people who are like who are smart in the sense that they're quick witted and they can stay on message, and maybe they're not the deepest. Most sort of intellectual philosophical thinkers, but man, I can't see how you could argue that he's not that smart.
I think he's transparently a lightweight, and he only got in the first time because he it was like a 2-week sprint and nobody could see it. I don't think he wears well over time. That guy played Ebola and ISIS probably more than anyone out there. And I think that was not a winning strategy. He also played immigration harder than most. And that didn't.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a very interesting point, Bill. I really do. You know, for a while, he was. Let's compare him to Ed Gillespie, and it's not a perfect analogy, but you know, Scott Brown was really taking it to Gene Shaheen. He was driving the discussion. He was running as this sort of populist, talking about the border, talking about ISIS, getting a lot of attention, and everyone thought. Coming close to winning in a really tough state. Conversely, you had Ed Gillespie, who, frankly, I thought was really running a very tepid campaign, staying below the radar, not really mixing things up. He did have this one ad where he kind of defended the Washington Redskins name, but even that I thought was done in a kind of a milquetoast sort of way. And yet you have Gillespie come out of nowhere and possibly win. We'll see how that turns out. He's down right now, but who knows. And Scott Brown, you know, there was some talk about not conceding, but he eventually did late into the night. So I do think it's interesting, Bill, that Scott Brown made the choice to run. You know, he was a moderate from Massachusetts, and that he did make the choice to run as sort of a hard, sort of a populist conservative was an interesting choice that he did make.
Well, I think this is where. Shaheen stands out. You know, she ran a race. You look at her ads. She drove. She had some populist themes. She hit Brown hard on being in the pocket of big oil and being a senator that works for Wall Street. I think she hit that a little harder than a number of other Democratic Senate candidates out there. But also of big importance, she was very. On point on what she delivered to New Hampshire. I kept the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard open. I got the federal prison reopened. I got they had one ad saying, we want a VA center in Keene for 30 years, and Jeanine cut through the red tape and made it happen. So she could point to actual stuff that she delivered on. You know, for example, you know, Mark Pryor in Arkansas, you know, he tried to creatively sell Obamacare. You know, he didn't use the phrase Obamacare, but he talked about what aspects of the bill that were popular that he wanted to protect. You know, the payoff on Obamacare is still very abstract to people. And whereas you can see the prison, you can see the VA center, you can see the shipyard, that you can get your arms around that a little bit more. So I don't think there were a lot of other incumbent Democrats that ran that way, or necessarily maybe didn't have the concrete things to point to that you know she that she had. So I think that's where there was a difference there, and it doesn't necessarily. It does suggest you look at say McConnell in Kentucky. We talked about this a little bit more. You know, one of the things he had in his back pocket to defuse the war on women was that he got a bill through just this year, you know, in the fall. That was going to expedite getting rape kits, DNA testing, you know, to police officers.
Right, and the woman who's the namesake right. of that bill
she speaks in the ad.
Appeared
she credits McConnell directly.
Appeared for in an ad on
to
his...
women, but you couldn't do that ad if you were obstructionist from start to finish. Now maybe McConnell was obstructionist, you know, 99.8% of the time, but he knew I better get one thing in there. I better slip that clause in that omnibus bill, and then I'm going to run that ad on it.
Let me just say this. I get that Mitch McConnell's not a great conservative, although he is good on some issues. I cannot help but having a sort of grudging admiration for the guy because he is a fighter. And these signs that were held up, that they've been around for a few months at least, but it's like a picture of Mitch McConnell and the words say, "Come at me, bro." I think that's brilliant. I don't exactly know what it means other than the fact that the guy has fended off, you know, Matt Bevin and Allison Leonard and Grimes. And, you know, obviously there's sort of a pop culture aspect to it. But Mitch McConnell has become sort of the fact that he's on the cover of like Time magazine now with a sort of Obama-esque painting on the cover. The fact that he's become like iconic is quite interesting. All things considered.
Now, the other thing that I'm sad about today, more than most, is Martha Coakley, is my home state gubernatorial loss. It's because I feel like she's gotten a bad rap and she's being treated like sort of like the ultimate choker, awful candidate. And I just have respect for people who do the work, who do a lot of unglamorous stuff for a lot of years. And as I wrote in Real Clear Politics in my analysis of the race on Monday, you know, the Massachusetts Democrats actually generally lose governor's races. It's not like she is sort of an unusual case. We lose governor's races since 1990. You know, Deval Patrick, the current governor, is the exception to the rule. And the reason why Deval Patrick is different than the others is that he came from outside state government, not up from it. And so he didn't have any, a lot of controversial decisions to defend. You know, when you're attorney general, you're in the middle of everything. And you step on a lot of toes. And you take up a lot of time in your campaign trying to defend yourself from that sort of stuff. And it bedeviled her in this campaign. But of all the races that we're talking about today, I can't think of another one where the Democrat did better than the polling. You know, all the Democrats are talking about, even in these competitive races, you know, we're seeing wide Republican victories in races that were supposed to be a lot closer. You know, Baker was up by about 3 in the poll averages, and there are some polls that had him up by 6 or 7 late in the game, and it ended up being a 1-point race. Now, part of that is Baker had this big flub at the end where he told this tearful story that ended up not being totally true, and that stalled his momentum. But also, you know, one of the reasons why I made the my for entertainment purposes only prediction last week was on the premise that the polls were not going to capture the strength of the Democratic ground game, or not factoring in a lot of unlikely voters showing up. That largely was not true across the board. But in Massachusetts, she did pick up that ground game, and they did give her a few extra points. Whereas Republicans don't have much of a ground game in Massachusetts; they're terrible everywhere else across the state. But the one thing going on in Massachusetts, I think, applies to Maryland and probably some other areas. I haven't looked at all the different situations. Was taxes, and this is a tough thing for Democrats to have to deal with, because you know, at the end of the day, if you're a Democrat and you want active government, you got and you're fiscally responsible, you got to pay for it. It's going to involve a certain degree of revenue increases. And in Massachusetts, this is something that I think undermines the notion that there's sort of this fossilized one-party rule. You know, last year, Deval Patrick proposed a pretty progressive income tax increase. Massachusetts has a flat income tax via the Constitution, so they can't have a graduate income tax, but he tried to increase
Massachusetts yes. has a flat yes. tax?
Well, in a lot of states,
that's
too.
Awesome.
That's not unusual for states.
Well, I didn't know Massachusetts did. Yes. I love the flat tax. I think we should have. I think there's the fair tax and there's all these other the 999 thing. I like the flat tax. I'm a flat taxer. Tax.
They have a lot of fees. You know, they have a sales tax.
Yeah, well, that's where they get you. Right. But good to hear.
Well, here's the
good
problem.
Good to hear that about Massachusetts. And by the way, I think it's fair to say Mitt Romney introduced many of those fees.
Right.
Right.
Well, and all governors do because they are hamstrung by the income tax. There's not a lot of things to do if you want to raise revenue. So, you know, two things.
You could raise the flat tax. You could raise that.
Well,
right?
everybody pays the same. There was a voter approved initiative a couple years ago that said that the income tax should go down, and the legislatures haven't abided by that. So that kind of chafes at local residents. And Patrick and I was proposing to increase it by a full percentage point while lowering the sales tax. When he proposed that, the Democrats in the legislature balked. They thought that was politically toxic. And they passed instead a gas tax increase tied to inflation. The net revenue of that was much, much less than what Patrick was asking for. And Patrick, in fact, vetoed it, and it was passed over his veto. So it's actually an example of Democrats snubbing their governor, not a case of one-party rule. But because they tied it to inflation, Baker really hammered that in the campaign, saying these guys don't even want you to have a chance to cut the tax. They want to go on autopilot. And it got repealed at the ballot box at the same time. So it's real hard, even in a liberal state sometimes, to do a tax increase, particularly in a situation where people feel that they're being economically pinched, and it's a shame spiral to the bottom, because in tough economic times you want to actually put some money into your infrastructure, help create some jobs, stimulate some economic activity, and now because that money was going to be dedicated to infrastructure improvements, and now it's gone away. And I saw the ads in Maryland, which I hadn't been following before, and they hit. It was the Democrat lieutenant governor that was running. They tied him to the current governor, hammered him on tax increases, and at a time when incomes generally are flat. And they said that the Maryland's economic performance was near the bottom. I don't know the veracity of that, but that's what they said in the ads. So Democrats have a very hard time. There are examples where Democrats do sell tax increases just fine, with effort, but they still do it. Obama, got away with it in 2012. Mark Warner, and when he's governor of Virginia, engineered a tax increase and is still very popular, even though he had a tough race this time around. He still got to the Senate despite having a tax increase as governor. Jerry Brown just coasted in California, and he's done tax increases there. So I'm not saying it's always a dead letter, but it's tricky. It's definitely tricky. Something else that's tough for Democrats too, I think, is the question of spending. A lot of Democrats ran as against wasteful spending. Gary Peters, who won in Michigan, actually hit that theme pretty hard, but a lot of Democrats also hit it and still lost. And this is something that I think is tough for Democrats. Why do you do more about jobs? Why don't you do more about the economy? Well, Obama had a bill called the American Jobs Act, but it involves spending money. He's going to pay for it with tax increases on corporations. But Democrats generally ran away from that because they were afraid of being tagged as big spenders. And so that puts Democrats in a box. Well, if you're not for that, what are you for to help the economy? They hung a lot on minimum wage, which is popular, and it won by ballot initiative in four states, in red states. But it's probably not enough to be seen as a comprehensive economic strategy. And if you want to do something bigger on the economy and you're a Democrat, it's going to involve money. And so if you can't sell that, if you can't figure out how to sell it, you're probably going to get boxed in.
All right. You're starting to overcome me with facts and numbers and tax talk. So let me hit a couple.
Am I ruining your good day? Then good. Suck on that.
Yeah. A couple of things I wanted to say before we turn in. One was that, I think I was surprised, not surprised, but I think we could agree that we haven't really talked about Kansas yet. I mean, Greg Orman refused to say who he would caucus with, ends up losing to Roberts. A lot of people surprised by that. North Carolina, Tillis wins over Hagan, another sort of surprise. Georgia, Purdue wins without the runoff. I think it surprised a lot of people. So, I mean, across the board, the Senate races were interesting. I think Allison Lindergan Grimes sort of refusing to say if she voted for Obama, again, probably didn't help her. It turned out to be a much not that close of a race. But, Bill, I do want to say that I think there's an underplayed story, which is the history that Republicans have made last night. I'll just go through a list of some of them. Tom Cotton becomes the first Iraq war vet in the U.S. Senate. Tim Scott becomes the first, African-American elected statewide in South Carolina since Reconstruction.
He was appointed before.
He was appointed before. You have Joni Ernst and Shelley Moore Capito both becoming the first women to make it to the U.S. Senate in their respective states, West Virginia and Iowa, respectively. You have my old friend Alex Mooney, who was very recently the chairman of the Maryland Republican Party, winning Shelley Moore Capito's House seat in West Virginia, becoming the first Hispanic, I think, ever elected.
Our Democrats ran hard against him as a carpetbagger for being from Maryland and kept it competitive, I guess, but I don't know what the final spread was.
It wasn't that close, but he overcame that charge, and I think he's the first Hispanic elected in West Virginia to Congress, certainly. His mom's a Cuban immigrant. His uncle, Javier Suarez, former mayor of Miami. You have example, Mia Love becomes the first Haitian American elected to the U.S. Congress, the first black Republican woman. You have Elise Stefanik out of New York. It becomes the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. These are all Republicans, folks. I'm sure I'm missing some people here. I made a list. I don't know how. Did Carl DeMaio? I don't know if Carl DeMaio won.
I think that's still being counted.
There's a chance that Republicans would elect the first openly gay, non-incumbent Republican to Congress last night. So it was a night of firsts, and it doesn't get mentioned a lot. But and these aren't just, some of them are the first Republican, but some of these are just firsts. And the Republicans, are more interested, I think, in diversity of ideas than sort of ethnic or gender diversity or whatever, the sort of identity politics. But, you add this up and then you throw in the fact that Republicans already dominate amongst, minority top tier candidates, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Brian Sandoval, Susana Martinez, Nikki Haley, Bobby Jindal, the aforementioned Tim Scott. I don't know what it means, but it's not a bad thing if you're a Republican and you're looking to build a strong and diverse bench going forward.
No, it's definitely a step they needed to take. I think they're getting beyond just having a single token like a J.C. Watts and then calling it a day. They're starting to get a younger generation of folks in and diversifying, but it still isn't clear if that is going to make them competitive in those communities going forward. One of your prolific articles coming out of last night points out that the 2016 electorate is going to look different than the 2014 electorate. They won again in this midterm with an older, wider electorate than in 2012. It's not that they pulled in a lot of African-American votes They cut down their gender gap in a lot of cases, in some cases, but there still is a gender gap. Kay Hagan still had a huge vote with women in North Carolina. She was running in North Carolina attacking Tom Tillis for defunding Planned Parenthood, which is a long way away from Jesse Helms' hands it had. She didn't lose women in North Carolina by doing that. You can look at a case like Colorado. I mean, I think you also talked about sort of the war on women being over here. The cases where Republicans, neutralized that gap or flipped it around, it was because they were sounding kind of socially moderate. They're running, Cory Gardner was running on being for birth control. Larry Hogan in Maryland was running on being for birth control. I talked about Mitch McConnell talking about, neutralizing the domestic violence issue by getting a little bill through on rape kits.
Yeah.
I don't know if this means the Republican Party is prepared as a party to fully recalibrate in that way, but those seem to be the tactics that help cut down that gender gap problem.
Well, let me say first, the problem with writing, there's a lot of great things about writing for diverse publications and diversifying and writing at different outlets. The downside is when they all want you to write something original for them on election night. So I have written three entirely different pieces last night, and one of them at the week is The War on Women, RIP, rest in peace. This isn't going to go away, really, but if you were looking to pinpoint the night that The War on Women really, died in terms of being the dominant issue that it was, you really couldn't pick a better night than November 4th, 2014, when you had Cory Gardner, who was accused by NARAL of wanting to ban condoms or something silly like that.
I disagree with that interpretation of that ad, and I was not saying that.
You had Cory Gardner, who was attacked by Mark Uterus, as he was dubbed, winning pretty big in Colorado, a very purple state. And you had Sandra Fluke losing a congressional race.
Well, she lost to a Democrat.
Okay, but still, Sandra Fluke loses, and Cory Gardner wins. I write columns, Bill. You're looking for it. You got to have a narrative here. Always root for the story, my friend, and that's the story, and I'm sticking to it.
But I don't know the Fluke race intimately, but this does sort of speak to the Democratic strategy to use a lot of outside surrogates. I mean, they were flying in, Bill and Hillary, Obama to a lesser extent in certain governor's races, Elizabeth Warren went to a lot of states, trying to jack up the base vote. There's a certain logic to it in that if you want to get a big rally, if you want to get a lot of people in a room that you want to then urge to go, make phone calls and door knock, you got to have a big name. But there's really no evidence that an outside endorsement is going to, flip a vote at the end of the day. So Democrats seem to sort of have been relying on these big names coming in a lot, and I think that's of limited utility. And probably in the case of Sandra Fluke, seemingly parachuting into a race with a degree of fame, probably does only get you so far. When at the end of the day, you gotta knock on doors and turn out votes and be seen as present in that community and being involved in the community issues. I think the Democrats should be more careful about relying on celebrity names to help them in tough times. They need to be thinking about how to, what's going to actually move a vote at the end of the day. It's probably not going to be having a name.
Well, we could talk about this all day, Bill. There's so many variables, so many factors to what happened. I think another thing that bears mentioning, and you've sort of implied this, although I don't think I completely agree with your take on it, but Republicans really did nominate some good, serious candidates. And they were pragmatic. Right now, Cory Gardner is in the U.S. Senate or is going to be in the U.S. Senate, and Ken Buck is going to be in the U.S. House. He won decisively, Cory Gardner. They made that switch. And I don't know, if 4 or 5 years ago Republicans would have been that pragmatic, I think Ken Buck would have said, you know, forget it. This is I'm running for this seat. They made a very pragmatic decision to sort of switch seats there. Chuck Todd, you know, was controversial thing he said on Morning Joe Tuesday morning. But he said something to the effect of, you know, Republicans were smart, sort of dodged a bullet that Chris McDaniel wasn't part of the story, that he didn't win that, you know, if he had won in Mississippi and was on the ballot, you know, the media and the left could have dug up things he said or in the past or on the trail or whatever, and sort of extrapolated that and made it out to be, sort of bigger than it really is, the way that like Sharon Angle and Christine O'Donnell's comments and gaffes, and certainly, you know, Murdoch and Aiken, certainly Aiken, the legitimate rape thing, line.
All those cases in 2010, 2012, not only did those individual dumb comments throw away races they could have won and given away individual Senate seats, but Democrats were successful in blowing up into national stories.
Yeah. And McDaniel would have been very well could have played into that in 2014 and others too. But McDaniel would have been an obvious example of someone who, going to cockfights and things like that.
Right. I think it was Brad Dayspring that was criticizing the Udall campaign and saying, you know, they were running a campaign against Ken Buck, and you didn't realize they were running against Cory Gardner.
I will say this: Jim Anto made a really good point. I mean, there's a side of Mark Udall that I kind of like, which is his stance on civil liberties. And I don't know, you know, I mean, obviously he had a strategy, but I would have, like, you know, and I'm not a voter in Colorado, it doesn't really matter what I think, but Ken Buck, Mark Udall went out of his way to piss off somebody like me with the kind of campaign he ran, whereas you can certainly root for the guy as a champion of civil liberties, and it seems like, I think it was Jim Antle on Twitter who said he really accentuated his worst qualities and really downplayed the most likable parts of him.
Well, I think it's a little unfair that he ran ads about his civil liberties work. He that was his way to say, I'm not a carbon cut of Obama. I stood up to Obama on the NSA. I have proof of that. You know, I mean, it's what he had, and he went with it. So I think there's two things there. One, Democrats are correct in that people don't like personhood amendments. You know, they lost again at the ballot box in Colorado and North Dakota. Similarly, Democrats are correct that people like minimum wage increases. Those won in 4 red states. But if they only can work as wedge issues if your opponent complies and firmly takes the opposite position. If they actually move off the dime towards you, then that message becomes a lot harder to sell. And they try to say, well, Cory Gardner is being a phony. But if you don't have a Todd Aiken type, buttressing that notion, a person might well say, look, you know, maybe Cory Gardner is a phony, but if he's running this way, then he can't vote that way. He knows where the state is at, and he's going to be bound by the state's lean, and the fact that he's campaigning so vociferously this way tells me that he gets that. So if you're noticing your opponent moving off the dime, you have to then adjust your campaign strategy too. Republicans, you know, by and large, didn't walk into those pitfalls that they did in 2010 and 2012. That does speak well to the issue. We're not on the verge of having a slew of personhood amendments become law, but it's not good for Democrats. And think about what else do we do now that the Republicans have given up the
and in fairness to Mark Udall, if his political strategy was contingent on winning the votes of center right journalists living in Virginia, it might not be a smart strategy. But we could talk.
Well, there's also a point there that the NSA issue, I think, has very limited political salience. And I think it's been true for a long time, and the hardcore civil libertarians don't want to admit that. But that just is not a voting issue.
Sadly.
Beyond like a very small
hardcore. We could talk all day, but here's the thing, Bill. I think that the suits who pay us quite well at Blogging Heads want us to wrap this up so they can post. I think they want to get something up on the elections. And because We are under contract with them. We should probably oblige. But any parting, right. Mea culpas, parting words, words of wisdom.
I regret nothing. I don't regret having faith in a good ground game. this is a lesson to all that my predictions are generally worthless. But hopefully my analysis.
All right, it's always good stuff. Stay classy, Northampton, and we will see you all back here in the DMZ in the new era of the DMZ show starting next week.
See ya. Take care.